Apple helps the people of Japan, Wi-Fi really can crash planes, and the Zune has been deep sixed. All that and more on the Slongcast. Hello, hello, everybody, and welcome to the Slongcast. I am your host, Kevin Slonka, and as usual, with me is Mr. Ryan Lancey.
Howdy.
We're up to episode 27. Can you believe that?
Yep.
You can't believe that.
But beware the Ides of March.
Oh, that's today, isn't it?
Yep.
I don't know what that means.
Well, if you were Caesar, you'd know what it means.
Good thing I am not Caesar. Et tu, Ryan A. So
is that my name in Latin, Ryan A?
Yes, I don't know if you knew that,
okay.
But you know now.
Awesome.
So you've all probably already noticed that my voice is lower than normal and crackly.
Hit puberty, folks.
I did. There's a lot of celebrating going on yesterday after the Northrop Grumman team won the Johnstown Somerset Easter Seals Office Olympics.
Congratulations.
Yay! Wait, I have something for that. Okay, I don't want to get too corny. I knew I had that applause on this computer for some reason. But I also have a little apology to make that last week I blamed the stuttering video on upgrading to the new version of Flash. And after after multiple Firefox crashes during the show last week, I realized that there was a malformed third-party plugin of some sort. Either it was Flash or Java, something on one of the web pages that we were looking at. That ended up causing the stuttering and crashing my browser. So
I knew it.
So I'm sorry, Adobe. Your Flash isn't that bad. I still maintain that it's crashtastic. A lot of news sources were pointing out that the new version still crashes a lot, but that wasn't the cause of my problem. So Adobe, I'm sorry.
Yeah, I think you owe Shantanu Narayen an apology.
I don't know who that is.
He's the CEO of Adobe.
Oh.
According to Google.
Is he not American? What's going on here?
I don't know.
I tell you what, I can't pronounce his name. So big story of the week, kind of a sad story, is what happened in Japan. Do you hear about all this?
Yeah, it's awful.
I don't want to make light of it, but it's almost as if everybody over there, their last name is Murphy. You know, it's like everything that could go wrong did go wrong. They had an earthquake. The earthquake triggered a tsunami. And those two things together triggered partial meltdowns in multiple nuclear power plants.
Like, yeah.
Really?
Yeah, it's crazy.
I can't believe that.
Yeah. Interestingly, I saw a little story on Reddit there. You know, someone was like, and you really don't think nuclear power is safe, you know, like, and they quoted all the things that happened to the reactor, and yet it still hasn't. Has anyone died from the radioactivity?
I don't believe. I didn't see anything.
So, I mean, in terms of nuclear power, I mean, we're still not out of the. Out of the woods yet, but
they're running radiation tests on the people who were close to it, and they are detecting radiation on the people and things that are around it, but I don't think it's killed anybody yet.
No, I mean, they said there's, you know, they're at higher risk for thyroid cancer, but they've been giving out some kind of pills that help block that.
Oh, that's cool. I didn't know about that.
Yeah, I guess they're iodine pills, and what it does is it fills your thyroid with iodine, so your thyroid can't absorb any more iodine.
Oh.
And then the radioactive iodine doesn't get into your system or something like that.
That's pretty genius.
Well, yeah, but it only protects against radioactive iodine in one type of cancer, thyroid cancer.
Right.
So
we need iodine pills that fill our whole body with iodine.
And with multiple elements.
Iodine and lead. Mostly lead.
Strontium and cesium and all the different radioactive elements. But, yeah, it's terrible what happened. But there seems like there's been a lot of goodwill.
There has been a lot of goodwill. I don't know how many other wireless companies are doing this, but Verizon is actually offering free calling and free texting to any numbers in Japan. So as long as you have Verizon landline or Verizon wireless, they say postpaid wireless, so Verizon wireless where you pay a monthly bill, not a prepaid call pay-as-you-go plan, you can pretty much call and text for free to Japan. And, you know, they're doing this so the people can check in on their, you know, family members or friends who are over in Japan, and because normally that would be ridiculously expensive. And they're like, you know what? This is a big enough tragedy. here, do it for free. You need to contact people. Have you heard of any other companies doing this?
Yeah, I mean, Google, well, I don't know about the wireless, but Google has like a, you know, a website up on their front page. You can, well, a link to it. And it's like sort of a, what do they call it? Like a catastrophe website.
Right, right.
It has like links to like different resources and ways to find friends and family.
Yeah, and there are, you know, despite there being a lot of scams out there, because there are a lot of emails going out and text messages going out, unsolicited ones, trying to get people to quote-unquote donate money to Japan. You know, there are some good ones out there, such as the Red Cross. You know, I did this yesterday or the day before. You know, you text the word Red Cross to 90999, and that automatically puts $10 extra on your cell phone bill, and the $10 goes to Japan. But this article from Intimobile.com also lists, it looks like maybe 10 or so different ways that you can contribute to the Japan relief efforts. And another cool thing, this was actually an email sent to David Prager, Kevin Rose, and I believe it's Alex Lindsay. It's addressed to Alex L., so I'm not sure who that is, but Kevin Rose posted the email on his blog. Apparently somebody he knows works in Japan. They're a manager of one of the stores in Japan, and they wanted to let Kevin know because they know Kevin can let the entire world know, you know, how cool Apple was being to all of the people over there in Japan. So if you're looking at the article, I have a bunch of points highlighted there of what they did. So basically, you know, 7 hours and 118 aftershocks later, the Apple store in Japan was still open. And one thing, you know, you think you only see it in movies, but, you know, in older movies, whenever a catastrophe happens and everybody kind of gathers around the electronics store outside the store to watch the news on the TVs that are still on, you know, that's exactly what happened over in Japan. Everybody crowded around the Apple store because the Apple store was the only place with working internet. So the people who were near the Apple store could get their devices, you know, on Wi-Fi, get out to the internet, contact their family. And that doesn't really talk much about what Apple did, but here is what Apple did. They basically told all of their staff, retail and corporate, so not just the bigwigs, you know, if you're stranded here, sleep in the store. No big deal. We don't mind. Well, then the Apple staff, you know, told their families, you know, we can't go anywhere. We can't get out. We're sleeping at the store. And their families were like, hey, that's a lot safer than where we are. You know, our stuff is crumbling. Can we stay? And Apple's like, yeah, whatever. You know, bring your family, bring anybody you want. You can all stay in the store. And I mean, there's a lot of other things that Apple did. You know, they paid for people who could get out. They paid for all of their expenses, taxi, hotels, any expense they incurred along the way. Apple said, we will cover you. It, you know, your safety is our top priority. I think this is pretty cool.
Oh, yeah. It's definitely, it's what you expect, honestly.
It really is. In times like this, you would expect every company to do this.
I think that's the key. You know, I don't, like, you know, when Katrina hit the New Orleans and in the Gulf Coast, I'm sure most of the businesses down there, in absence of support from the federal government at the time, were doing everything they could do to support their local communities. It's what you do when you're a business.
Yeah, definitely. And especially if you're Apple. I mean, yeah. You have the largest market cap in the world. You know, come on. And yeah, they were doing that. You know, executives from Cupertino and London FaceTimed with the people in Japan and, you know, basically said, you know, don't worry, whatever cost for anything ever, you know, while you're getting through this, we'll just write it off. You know, we'll give you the money you need, so don't worry about it. So I just thought that was really cool that, you know, Apple came through for all of these people, everyone who was around the Apple store.
Yeah, I think these types of things can really be a big boon to a company's PR stance. You know, for instance, John Deere, the tractor company, unrelated to this event, but it enjoys a pretty high, you know, standard in consumer, you know, services or whatever, or public relations, all that stuff. People really like John Deere tractors. They have a good name.
Yeah, they're pretty much the name when you think of tractors.
Right, in the United States, at least. I mean, there's a lot of others, but they're the most popular, and people really support them. And part of that probably goes back to, you know, in the Great Depression, they had a company policy of not repossessing any equipment from farmers during the Great Depression that was John Deere, you know, was like financed or something like
right,
that.
Right, right.
And that led to some of their, you know, their good feelings toward the company. So,
yeah, this if some of those people over in Japan weren't Apple customers, they probably will be, you know, once they get back on their feet and start making money again.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of companies that are really helping out. Like you said, Verizon, Google's got a really nice web page where you can, it's got a person finder where you can click you're looking for someone or you have information about someone that's looking for someone else. And they have a lot of emergency numbers and different information on their web. They actually have a QR code you can scan to get
the
website.
Oh, I didn't even see that.
Yeah.
Yeah, so definitely, you know, if you haven't donated, you know, every place is pretty much asking for $10, so I'm sure everybody can spare $10. Find some way to donate to help out those people. And what you may not have known, because it's not that wildly advertised unless you're, you know, in the tech circle and you pay attention to all these things that happen in San Francisco and that, is that South by Southwest happened this weekend.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe you have something that just launched there.
Yeah, I've been following the timeline for, you know, Internet Explorer version 9, and they really had a release candidate not too long ago. There was a beta back in, I don't know when that was, like probably late last summer, early fall. And now they have the official launch for IE9, which happened yesterday. They announced it at South by Southwest. I went ahead and downloaded it, got the, you know, latest version. I mean, there wasn't a whole lot of change, you know, in terms of like look or anything from the beta to the RC, even to the release, but I can tell through each iteration, they've cleaned up a lot of bugs. The release candidate was down to just some like little issues. Like one bug I noticed was when I went to Engadget, as you would scroll down the page, once you like stop scrolling, the screen would jitter up a couple pixels and then back down like every time. You'd scroll the screen. That's gone. I mean, it's like a really simple bug.
That's a good thing to remove.
Yeah, well, it's barely noticeable, honestly. Barely noticeable. But I noticed.
Right. And it was probably pretty annoying.
Yeah, you know, I was like, oh, well, I guess it won't be my primary browser because Chrome is so solid. But I just have to say, wow. I mean, it's this product that they released is really impressive. It's definitely their best browser by far. It's got the minimalist style. It supports HTML5 or a good portion of it. You know, not everything, but
yeah. I was gonna say, I know we talked about this at other random times along the process, but what do you think? I mean, if I'm a Chrome or a Firefox user, or even an IE7 or 8 user, what does IE9 do that makes me want to switch?
Well, I think the biggest thing for Windows users is the hardware acceleration. As we get, you know, more and more complex websites that use features of HTML5 and other things, the hardware acceleration that IE9 provides on at least the Windows platform, you know, I think that's probably all they'll release it for. I don't know if they still do a Mac version or not.
I think it's pretty old, the one that they have.
Yeah, for Mac. But it's a big difference. They have, obviously, there's no like real world use for it yet, not or very little, but there's a couple demos at their website, which is beautyoftheweb.com. It's pretty impressive. Like, you run the same website in Chrome or another browser, and it's just like it just dies. Like, you know, like can't handle the load of rendering the graphics.
Yeah, I don't know if a lot of people know this, but you know, pretty much once HTML5 came out and the canvas tag was standardized and browsers started using it, you know, there were people converting like a Quake, you know, and Myst, maybe not Myst, but definitely Quake, into, you know, a 3D shooter game and making it run completely in a browser.
Mm-hmm.
Like that's just ridiculous. And it seems that IE9 is going to handle, you know, you might not be playing games in a browser, but if it can handle 3D games like Quake inside of a web browser, you know, what else can it do? Like that,
yeah.
That's pretty ridiculous.
Yeah, it's impressive. I just ran the Acid 3 test on it. It gets a 95 out of 100 on the Acid 3.
Really?
Yeah.
That kind of sucks.
Yeah. Because
every other browser gets 100. You know, most of the WebKit, the newer WebKit-based browsers.
Yeah, I don't know. I know Chrome does. I haven't really messed with the other ones, but
I don't know that the new version of Safari does. I don't know because I don't run the new version of Safari. I know for the longest time you used to have to download the nightly build of WebKit for Safari to get it to completely pass acid.
Yeah, like I have Firefox loaded and I'm running, let's see, I don't know what version here, about, this is 3.613, and I get a 94 out of 100 on Firefox.
Yeah, I'm running it right now on Linux. I just got a 93 out of 100. It's a 3.517. That's pretty old, isn't it?
3.5.
What do you have?
3.6.
Yeah, so I'm like way behind on Linux. And
but I mean, so still, it's beating it by a whole point in Acid. Yeah.
I wish that Acid would tell you what broke.
I think there's a way to find that out. There's like a more detailed test.
I remember there used to be on some of the Acid tests a pop-up that happened at the end that listed all the tests and what passed. Maybe there's a special way to call it to get it. But either way, it looks like IE9 is definitely a step in the right direction for Microsoft. They're finally getting the point that, you know, like Chrome pointed out, that fast is better. So they definitely made it faster. And they definitely took steps in the security direction to help people out there. So one thing that is not cool. We've always talked about, you know, capping mobile plans. You know, everybody who gets data on their mobile phone, you probably have a 2 gigabyte cap or a 4 gigabyte cap or 5 gigabyte cap. And that's been happening for a long time on mobile phones. But what we're seeing now is AT&T capping regular house landline internet. So their DSL and their U-verse internet, they are imposing overage fees.
Bad AT&T, bad.
I mean, their U-verse product is their multimedia internet. Like, they market it. If you buy U-verse, you buy it because you want the fastest internet possible that you can stream all kinds of HD media. Like, they market it toward people who consume content in ridiculous amounts. And now they're charging you overages. So, like, 250 gigabytes per month is what U-verse now gets. And you will get charged $10 for every additional 50 gigabytes. That might not sound bad because 50 gigabytes is a lot, but still, I mean, an extra $10 when you're already paying probably $100 for this service. Like, really, yeah. AT&T?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I don't know. The problem with the internet services we have now are I think they're pretty mediocre in general. And at that mediocre level, I don't think they cost a lot of money to provide, but they have to invest in the future, you know, so like they need to still turn a nice profit to be able to build up enough, you know, capital. To,
I thought you were going somewhere else with this, but
yeah. You know what I mean? Like that's how I kind of look at it. I mean, I don't like it. I don't like it, but the other challenge is you do have these people that just abuse it. I mean, that are, you know, using hundreds and hundreds of gigabytes a month. And
but I mean, to that I say, who cares? Because there's such a small percentage that, yeah, they might be using 400 gigabytes a month, but everybody else in their area is lucky to use 1 gigabyte a month. You know, yeah. Is it really that bad of a thing that they have to start doing this?
Well, it's sort of like socialized internet in some ways, though. You know, like you're paying. If you're a low-end user, you're paying for that high-end user's use, or like maybe reverse socialism. I don't know how that works.
Yeah,
but you know, you're basically, well, it's actually kind of like, you know, medical insurance. Most people are paying higher premiums. They don't actually use the services when they're young, and then like, you know, if they get sick or they get older, then you know, well, everyone gets older, but you know, you're That's who the bigger users of the service are, sick and elderly.
Yeah, that's, I mean, as far as I go, I pay for the highest package my company offers, and do I use it? No, but it's nice to know it's there.
Yeah. So, yeah, in your example, you're just basically...
I'm paying for everybody else's medical insurance.
Yeah, it's a form of socialism, and I think it's the same with internet service. So, I mean, pick your poison, I guess. I mean, I would be all about fair internet pricing, or I'd be all about per megabyte internet pricing if the prices were fair, you know.
Yeah, they're definitely not fair at the moment.
Yeah, well, like if you look at like wireless prices, it's ridiculous.
Yeah, I mean, I was just talking to people about this today or similar things. You know, it seems like all of these companies, you know, mobile and landline, who are charging all these overages and capping, it's almost like they think that all of these digital bits come from a lake and the lake can dry up. It's like, no, that's not how the internet works. We're not going to run out of bits. We don't have to charge this kind of money and cap stuff because we're going to run out. It's not a natural resource.
Yeah, the electricity costs. Basically, the only resource that the internet consumes is electricity.
Right.
And that is a very small part of the overall, you know, expenditure on internet services. It's mainly manpower to keep them running.
Yeah, and I mean, I understand that, you know, their backhaul is the big deal. You know, they got to keep making that bigger if people start downloading more data. But, I don't know. Come on. I don't get it. But there was a pretty big story out of Engadget that just happened recently, wasn't there?
Yeah. So the other night, I was, you know, checking my Twitter feed, and I see this post from Joshua Topolowski. How do you say that?
Topolsky.
Okay, I was right the first time. And, you know, he's like, hey, thanks for the outpouring of, you know, emotions or whatever. And I was like, what? What happened? You know, so I like check his feed and he's like, he has this link to this article, Hello, I Must Be Going. And I'm like, uh-oh. So I click it and sure enough, he's leaving Engadget. So I've only actually... Josh Topolsky is the reason I got into Engadget. I've been a huge tech head for years, but I never was into Engadget until I saw him on Jimmy Fallon, actually, when he started his show.
Right.
He had the Palm Pre on.
Yeah, I remember that.
And that's sort of what got me into Engadget. I mean, I've been a long time like Ars Technica reader and Slashdot and other places, but that got me into Engadget.
And for those who don't know, real quick, Josh Topolsky was their editor-in-chief. Like, he was the dude in charge.
Yeah. So, you know, to see him go is kind of, I mean, it's disheartening. I mean, a lot of times I'm a little anti-Engadget because I think they lean fairly heavily towards the, you know, they just, everything Apple comes out looking like gold to them, which, I mean, it does for most reviewers, I think, nowadays, but... I don't think they give some of the other products out there a fair shake all the time. That's my opinion. But it doesn't mean that I don't like Topolsky. I think he was a great editor, and I think overall he did the whole tech industry a benefit.
Oh, definitely. And I just submitted an article to go along with your article that it wasn't only Topolsky who left.
Yeah.
Nilay Patel, Engadget's managing editor, left at the same time. So, you know, a lot of people on the internet were speculating, you know, what's the deal? Like, this is weird for Engadget's top two people to leave at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, the article talks about two other top editors that left recently.
Right, Ross Miller and another Miller, Paul Miller.
Yeah, so they were senior editors, and I think mainly it has to do with, you know, AOL's takeover of Engadget and some of the other things going on there.
Yeah, I was just watching the most recent twit, and they had Ryan Block and Peter Rojas on. Peter Rojas from Gizmodo and Ryan Block formerly from the head of Engadget. He was formerly the editor-in-chief of Engadget right before Josh Topolsky. And, you know, everybody asked him, you know, what's the deal? Is this, you know, them leaving because AOL was ruining Engadget or... is it Arianna Huffington? You know, she now pretty much owns AOL, so Engadget reports to her starting like this week or something.
But I thought AOL bought Huffington Post.
It that might have happened, but either way, Arianna is like everybody's
boss.
She's
in charge of like, news division. Yeah.
Yeah, but basically from what Ryan said, you know, no, that's not the case, because whenever Engadget negotiated the agreement with AOL, it was part of the agreement that AOL... could not screw with them editorially. Like, yes, AOL owns Engadget, but they can't tell them what to do content-wise. So Ryan Block made it clear that wasn't the reason that Josh and Nilay left. Mm. So whatever the reason was, you know, I was making a joke that it seems like Josh Topolsky now is going to go start his own crappy website. because that's kind of what Ryan Block did. You know, he went and started GDGT, or Gadget, like they call it.
Yeah.
And I don't know what to use it for. I don't visit there. You know, it doesn't seem useful to me. I'm wondering if Josh is going to go try to start something else and have it fail like Ryan Block's new site did.
Yeah, I mean, GDGT, Gadget.
Yeah, it's called Gadget. Gadget.
It got a lot of press early on.
Well, and I think that's only because Ryan Block and Peter Rojas started it.
Yeah, I mean, I remember, you know, what's his face talking about it? Sorry, Leo Laporte. And
what's his face?
Yeah. Sorry, Leo, if you're listening, which you're not, but if you are, sorry.
I'm going to send this to him.
Yeah. I remember him, you know, they were interviewing them, and I kind of thought at the time, like, I don't know what this is useful for.
Yeah, I made an account, and I started filling out all my gadgets, and I've never went back.
Yeah, same. I think I have sort of the same experience. I think that it had potential in that you could, like, connect with other people who own the gadgets that you own, you know, for, like, technical support.
Right.
And it's sort of like a way for tech support companies, like a tech support Twitter in a way or something, you know? But it just didn't catch on. And
yeah, I mean, maybe I need to hear it straight from Ryan and Peter what that site is about, because I have no clue.
Yeah.
Anyway, we have some Facebook stories. We always have Facebook stories. There's always something with Facebook. And this one is just kind of a little, I don't know what the word is. It's not ironic or whatever. I'll explain it. You'll see what I'm saying. So Facebook has a real name policy. Basically, when in the real name fields on Facebook, if you don't have your real name in there, they will shut you down. You know, they will disable your account. You need to have your real name in the real name fields. Whether you display that to people or not, you know, is up to you, but you need to have the real name fields. And this Chinese blogger, who has gone by the name of Michael Ante for many, many years. I don't know what it says in here. It says more than a decade. So more than 10 years, this pretty famous Chinese blogger has gone by an Americanized name so that people know who he is. His Chinese name was Zhao Jing, so I guess that was a lot harder to remember for most people. So he made an American name, as most Chinese people do when they come to this country. And Facebook basically shut him down. And the dude's like, whoa, Zuckerberg, your dog has a Facebook page. Did you seriously just shut me down for not having my real name in the Facebook real name fields? Do you see any problem with this type of stupid enforcement?
Well, I don't know if it's stupid, because the problem that you're going to run into if you don't enforce some kind of, you know, policy is that you're basically just going to get a bunch of spammers making accounts on there, friending everybody, bombarding people.
But how do they know? Like, how can they enforce that I sign up with this email address and that is my real name? You know, like, how do they know? How did they know that wasn't his real name?
My guess is that they have sources from other personal information sources to, like, link your email to, like, valid data. And then they run some kind of heuristics on that data to determine that you're real or not.
Yeah, because they don't make you enter in SSN, do they? I don't think they do.
No.
Yeah, because I remember when I signed up for Square recently so that I could accept credit card payments on my iPhone, that it made me enter in, you know, the last 4 digits or whatever, my SSN, and then it asked me these questions like, you know, which one of these streets did you grow up on? Which one of these places have you lived? I'm like, holy crap, how did they get this? Oh, that's how. They did an SSN check on me and found all this information. But Facebook doesn't do that. So you're right. It's probably just heuristic, not 100% correct technology.
Probably not.
Yeah, I agree with you. It cuts down on spammers, but I just don't see how they can be so certain that they could go through and disable. Did they disable or delete? Do you recall what the article said?
I mean, I've been to, like, different websites where not websites, but forums that enforce real names policies. Usually they just disable your account until you enter it in. You know, disable it, you can't post or do anything.
Right.
Usually you can log in and you can change it, but I don't know what Facebook does.
Yeah, that's, I don't know. I like it in the sense that it tries to crack down on spammers, but I don't like it in the sense that they're just not always right. But in addition to this controversial real name policy, There was also a recent court decision that affects the way people use Facebook now. So somebody lost primary custody of her daughter because another person tagged her in a photo on Facebook. So basically, this lady was just, you know, somebody took a photo of her. She was drinking alcohol. I don't think they say exactly what kind. And posted on Facebook and tagged her in it. You know, no big deal. Everybody gets tagged in photos. But this was brought into the court of law because this lady was being treated for bipolar disorder. And the lawyers said alcohol negatively reacts with the medicine she's taking for bipolar disorder. Therefore, she is not a fit mother. Therefore, the judge ruled you don't get custody of your kid. And basically, you know, she tried to appeal and the judge is like, the basic decision is that you do not need somebody's permission to tag them in a Facebook photo. My personal thoughts on this? Duh. You know, if you're in public, you're in public. What, somebody can take a picture of you. It happens. If you don't want that to happen, don't be in public doing something.
Yeah. I pretty much agree. Although it's weird though, because like when you appear in a movie, they have to get a release for you to be in the movie. Like if you're like a bystander.
That is true, because I've been in like commercials and such, and they make me sign waivers.
I think technically, you do need the waiver. I don't.
I wonder what that's for then.
It might
maybe it's because they make money from it.
Maybe it might relinquish you from any claims to the money made.
Right. I think that might be what it is.
But in this, I wonder if they could make a case where. Okay, you put this photo on Facebook. People look at the photo. Facebook makes money from people looking at the photo.
And the bar makes money from them seeing that you had such a good time at the bar.
Well, yeah. But I think Facebook might be the person that they could go after in the sense that, hey, you need my release to use the picture. So really what Facebook might need to implement is a mandatory tag approval. You know, like if you tag somebody, they have to be on Facebook.
Or they get an email that says, go approve these tags.
Right. And then.
Oh, yeah. Sorry. I see where you were going with that.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
Yeah. I don't know. But if that's the case, I mean, then all of those customized, personalized ads where people's photos show up in that right hand bar, you know, Kevin just checked in at Starbucks. Are you thirsty for some coffee? You know, like there would need to be waivers or people can sue Facebook and Starbucks for that too. So I think it's kind of a slippery slope.
Well, but it might be a good one.
It might be a good one. However, the precedent has now been set in the wrong direction, you know, to go down that good slippery slope.
Well, maybe they just went after the wrong person.
That's very true. Very true. So as I always say, you know, if you're in public, you're in public. If you don't want to be seen drinking beer, drink beer in your house because that's the only place you're safe. So anyways, I believe you have some one article that kind of fits in with the whole lots of information on Facebook deal.
Yeah, there's an interesting article on internetevolution.com, and they talk about there was a paper written about why we may not have the right to be forgotten online, you know, in the sense that there's a history of your actions online, on Facebook, these different social websites. Do you have the right to sort of erase that or request that a page be taken down because you don't like what it says about you? And it's pretty engaging. The original thing that triggered it was a blog post by Peter Fleischer from Google about just, you know, his article is titled Foggy Thinking About the Right to Oblivion. So, like, you know, our right to sort of get our internet history or browsing history put into oblivion where no one can get to it anymore. It's been destroyed completely. There's no record of it. And there's a lot of challenges to this. One, I mean, obviously, is can you ever destroy something that was posted on the internet? You know, because it can get reposted somewhere else.
I think the answer to that is no.
Yeah, I mean, to entirely destroy it, it's pretty tough. But there's some interesting things that may happen. Like, for instance, if a person's right to privacy trumps, someone else's right to expression, you might have things like where, you know, the Nixon estate could try to strike down all references to Richard Nixon and the Watergate scandal because it's...
And then nobody could ever learn about Watergate.
Right. So, I don't know. There's some interesting concepts there that I hadn't really thought about.
Yeah, I didn't read the original paper, but maybe you can tell me this. Was this thing written for when people die? Like, to protect their legacy or remove a bad legacy?
I think they just gave that as an example of one reason it may be misused.
Okay.
And I think what spawned this on was that there was some French... A French court decided, or there was a case about what they called their, I don't know, it was in French, basically the right to oblivion.
Un châtier sur les droits.
Yes. Les oubli. And I think
I don't speak French.
That's probably French for like oblivion. It doesn't really.
A charter on the right to be forgotten.
Yeah, it doesn't really translate that last word, oubli. It doesn't translate to English in the sense like, you know, it basically its closest translation is like oblivion. But really it's the right to have the internet not remember you.
Right.
Which is, it's a pretty crazy concept, but I guess, you know, they support it there and implementing it's going to be tough.
Well, I mean, you think of it now, think of all the people who lived in the 1800s. Who of those people do we remember? We remember like five people. You know, who invented the telegram? Who invented the light bulb? You know, only people who did major inventions get remembered. Everybody else, nobody has any clue who they are. But nowadays, pretty much everybody gets remembered because there's something on Facebook or MySpace or Twitter. There's something.
No, nobody remembers them. But that's not to say that there's not a public record on them.
Well, okay, maybe remember isn't the right word.
But the thing is, there is a public record on those people, and if you have the right source, you can find it. Like, for instance, many historians have written books about, you know, certain, like a county in Pennsylvania. You can get the history of Cambria County, and in it, you can go and look at basically the entire lineage of a family, like when they emigrated, when they arrived in the United States, when they settled in Cambria County, their children, the businesses they own.
You need to tell me that book because I want to go get it.
Oh, yeah. I can show it to you. But, I mean, this stuff sort of... And actually, a lot of it's all public domain now because a lot of it was written 100 years ago. Well, no, just that it was written 100 years ago and the copyrights expired on it. And you can get it for free on Google Books. So, you know, a lot of this stuff, if you search Google Books, you will find stuff that those people not only were never on the internet... They never even knew anyone on the internet.
They didn't know of the internet.
They didn't know of the internet. It didn't exist. There weren't even digital computers yet.
Yeah, the only people who knew them were their neighbors on either side.
Right.
And now everybody does.
Yeah, yet you can search Google Books, find their name and the business they owned. So. Yeah.
And as this article points out, you know, for certain other people, you can find, were they a pedophile? Were they a murderer?
Yeah.
You know, all of these possible bad things.
Yeah, so... Now there's some good points. Like, you know, after someone pays their debt to society, maybe we should be able to erase their record or something, or, you know, maybe there should be a law against using that against them, you know, or something, but it's hard to like erase the records completely.
Yeah, I mean, this goes to a point that I often argue with people, you know, basically the Facebook relationship ordeal is what I'm going to call it. So you can pretty much find every girlfriend I've ever had based on my Facebook photo stream. You know, you go to concert somewhere, you take a picture with the person you're with. So you can pretty much tell every girl I've ever dated if you search through all of my Facebook photos.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, people shouldn't be able to use that against you or make you delete those because you have a new girlfriend now. You know, those parts of your life happened. You can't just erase them and make them not happen.
Yeah.
You know, so in the case where you just mentioned, you know, should you be able to wipe the slate clean once somebody pays their debt? Maybe, but what they did wrong happened. You know, you're not going to make it unhappen by erasing it from the internet.
I think the biggest things that have changed is that, generally speaking, photos have not been a very public aspect of our lives. that the photos that our friends take, you know, they probably get looked at once they were developed.
They used to be thrown into scrapbooks and put under your bed.
Yeah, or into a big bin and thrown in the attic. You know, so I think that's probably the biggest change that has people worried. And I think it is still a legitimate worry. I mean, I don't, you know, it sucks if somebody just, you know, you can just be not even doing anything stupid, but you're just in a weird pose when somebody happens to snap a photo, like halfway between picking something up off the ground. You just look weird, and then they make fun of you forever about it or something. Like
SNL did a sketch about that. I didn't ask for this.
Yeah.
And it was just things like that that people did, and then somebody made a YouTube auto-tune video of it.
Yeah.
It's like, really?
And it's just, you know, it's annoying, and it's not quite slanderous or not defamation.
Although, I mean, it is a little bit, you know.
Nah.
If they're making fun of you.
Well, slanderous means that they're saying something, like, untrue.
Well,
about
which,
you.
Yeah, but in the case, like you said, if you're halfway between picking something up off the ground and on the way up somebody snaps a picture and now it looks like you're trying to grab the person's butt beside you.
Yeah, that's true.
Now all of a sudden that's slanderous because they're making fun of you for trying to grab somebody's butt and you weren't.
You could probably make a case. You're probably right. So, but anyways, I think there's some interesting concepts, you know, that make you think about why it should be that way, why it shouldn't be. And I think the more people think about this and discuss it, you know, maybe we can come up with a workable solution.
Yeah, I just want to offer one last point. I know you wanted to tie that up, but it was something else that I just saw on Twitter. Gary Vaynerchuk was on there, and he wasn't talking about this article, but he was talking about something similar in that everything we do nowadays is recorded. You know, what we're doing right now will be listened to by our great-grandchildren. You know, hi, great-grandchild of mine. You know, little Johnny, whatever. You know, so he was saying that, you know, in this area, I think it goes, you know, right along with this article, in this era, everything we do is recorded in some form, audio, video, photo, whatever. So, you know, just be careful what you do.
Yeah. Especially here at Kevin's house where he records everything.
That's true. There are cameras in the walls. So I believe you have the next article also about something with Twitter.
Yeah, so I thought this was kind of interesting. You know, there's been a lot of, you know, buzz about Twitter and Facebook, different social networks, when they change terms of service. Well, recently Twitter changed their terms of service, and now there's some kinks in whether, basically they're saying they don't want anyone developing third-party apps anymore.
I don't think that's exactly what
they're
saying. Well,
that compete with products that are already out there.
Yeah, I think they're just saying, don't make a Twitter client because we have a billion of those.
Yeah.
You know, don't make something that all it lets you do is post and retweet and reply.
Yeah, but I mean, this is where it gets a little weird. Like, they have an API. You don't pay to use it, but yet they're restricting it.
Yeah, I guess it is in the terms of service now, so it kind of is a restriction.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know where Twitter's going with this stuff. Like, I really don't know. Like, have they made any money? Like, I mean, they don't license this API. They don't, at least from what I can tell, they don't.
Well, now they're putting, you know, ads and promoted tweets in all of their clients. It seems like they're wanting to own their ecosystem by telling people, we have a client. You don't need to do that. If you want to make something special case for what you do, sure, but don't just make another Twitter client. We got that covered.
Yeah. Well, do they have themselves a client other than the website?
They bought Tweety.
Oh.
And they turned that into the official Twitter client.
Okay. Tweety's the official Twitter client.
It's not called Tweety anymore. It's just called Twitter.
Oh.
Yeah.
Because, like, I don't know if I mentioned this before or if you followed it, but, like, a couple weeks ago, they changed some terms of service, or maybe they had changed it months before and people hadn't listened to them. But Uber Twitter, which is like one of the biggest Twitter clients on BlackBerry and probably a few other platforms, but
it's a very big mobile client. Yeah.
Yeah, it's huge on BlackBerry. It's probably the number one on BlackBerry, I'd say, at least from my experience. And it is a very good Twitter client. It's very cumbersome to set up in terms of, like, it's got a lot of questions it asks you, but in terms of, like, what it can do and some of the features, it's one of the best. But they changed something where you're not allowed to have Twitter in the name of the application anymore. So Uber Twitter was forced to change their name to something else. They chose Uber Social, which is fine. In my opinion, I think it's a good move to move to Uber Social, because that tells me, fine, we're going to support all kinds of social networks, not right. just yours.
If Twitter goes away, now we're going to be Uber Beluga.
Right. Or you know. Or maybe they could link into Foursquare.
Right.
And also do some parts of Facebook or something.
Yeah. And there was even another application that got hit with that too. I forget the name of it.
Yeah. So, I mean, everybody's feeling the pain. But, like, Uber Twitter was, like, offline for, like, 4 days. And I ended up switching to, like, the Twitter client on BlackBerry for a while, which had issues that I didn't like. And, you know, finally it came back and I was like, thank goodness.
Yeah. Once they cut the API key,
yeah,
you know, your stuff stops working.
Yeah. It's crazy.
Stupid Twitter. I guess we have yet to see what they're going to do with this these new terms of service.
Yeah.
So we have a couple security-based articles. For those of you who don't know, every year in Vancouver, I believe it's at the, I could be wrong, at the CANSEC West Conference, Canadian Security West. I think that's where this happens. But there's a pwn-to-own competition. And basically, if you can successfully exploit a machine that they have there, they have a bunch of machines. You know, they have a MacBook, they have a Windows machine. This one's running Safari, this is running Chrome, this is running that. If you successfully compromise a machine and get root privileges, you get to take the machine home. Like, that's yours. So exploit, you know, pwn to own. It's exactly what it is. You hack it, you get it. And one cool thing that came out of it, there's a lot of cool things, but this one specifically, that the MacBook was the first to fall. The MacBook running Safari. And, you know, everybody might laugh, ha-ha, Apple, not so secure. What I found funny and the reason why I wanted to talk about this was it was a vulnerability not so much in Safari but in WebKit.
Yeah.
So this kind of points out that every browser out there, every good browser, they all pretty much run WebKit. So they're all pretty much, you know, vulnerable to this now, and everybody has to patch. And it happened on a 64-bit machine, and I had heard that 64-bit was a lot harder to hack. You know, these guys said, you know, there was no hacks or no exploits out there. I know I say hack a lot and you probably want to punch me. You know what we talked about last week.
No, that's fine.
But I know there are not a lot of 64-bit exploits out there. These guys said they had to code everything from scratch because of that. And that got me thinking, why? So I looked it up and, you know, the second article I submitted for this just has a couple of things highlighted of why 64-bit is so much harder to hack. You know, one thing, the stack isn't executable. The stack has varying starting addresses. Rarely do you pass values on the stack in 64-bit environments. So, you know, a lot of normal people's shell code, basically a lot of the normal ways they would exploit standard 32-bit machines do not work on 64-bit machines. And they have to rewrite their code and do completely different ways to hack 64-bit machines. And that just, you know, caught me that a 64-bit machine was the first to fall because of how difficult it is.
Yeah. But according to Standard.io, below that, I guess he refuted a lot of that stuff there.
Yeah, he basically said that, sure, writing shell code, you know, isn't going to work, but you would just do these other ways to bypass, like, DEP and all of the other things that 64-bit implements. So the dude is definitely right. You can't use, you know, normal shell code programming that you use on 32-bit, and there are other ways.
Mm-hmm. There's one thing that I was surprised about. He did mention DEP, and at first I didn't even realize. Because when I think DEP, well, what I think about DEP is not, I don't call it DEP. I always call it like the no execute bit.
Yeah.
Same thing.
Yeah.
But I never think of it. DEP is like the Windows term for it, isn't it?
Yeah. You can actually enable or disable that in boot.ini or whatever the hell 7 uses to replace it.
But even at that, though, I think if it's enabled at the BIOS level, you can't override it, I thought.
I've never seen it at the BIOS level. I've only seen it in the boot.ini.
Right, but I mean, well, I guess what I'm saying is if the processor supports it, the BIOS enables it, and it can't be overridden. But if the processor doesn't support it, then it's a software configurable item.
I honestly don't know.
Well, anyway, I don't think that's an exclusively 64-bit thing. I thought that came out well before that. I shouldn't say well before 64-bit processors, but there were 32-bit processors that implemented it well.
Yes, there definitely are.
Yeah, so I don't know that he's correct. Like, I don't even think that's part of it.
I think he's just saying that normal exploit programming techniques,
yeah,
you know, that they're going to be different for 64, so you're going to have to learn a whole new way of doing things. You know, this guy was just saying, sure, it's different, and you're going to have to learn some stuff, but it's definitely doable.
For the listeners at home, what we're talking about with DEP and the no execute bit, one of the things that is unique, or not unique, but is, I guess, a side effect of having computers designed the way they are, where your storage memory and your execution memory are the same. That's a von Neumann architecture where it shares all of the...
Well, can you kind of explain what the difference is between the two?
Okay, so I have code, right? And that's just bits that execute. The processor grabs the instruction or the data from memory. The memory can contain either an instruction or data. Like the instruction...
Like a Word doc.
Right. The instruction might be add or multiply or move or store or whatever. And the data could be just a number, a letter and a word, whatever. The von Neumann architecture, which basically all PCs, Macs, modern phones, all that stuff use, is that all of that data and the instructions are in the same memory. The bad part about that is that if the... There's a thing, this gets more complicated than I thought. So like in a processor, a central processing unit, there's a program counter, which basically tells the processor where to get the next instruction from. So if I'm going through memory and I'm going down the memory locations, memory location one, memory location two, the program counter increments for each memory location that I'm going to next. If I am able to modify the program counter and point it to some other place in memory that is supposed to be data, but I put bad code there, then the processor will execute that bad code. That's how old processors worked. Well, sometime around the AMD Athlon 64, something around that time frame, they came out with this no execute bit or data execution prevention, meaning that memory locations that are storing data are flagged with an X. And that way, the processor knows not to execute it no matter what, even if the program counter gets switched.
Yeah, even if it detects an instruction there, it can't run it.
Well, it wouldn't detect it. It would be like the program counter would get pointed to that memory location. It would try to load that as an instruction, but it would see that it has an X beside it and say, oh, I can't run that.
It would just treat it as data, I guess, is what I wanted to say.
Yeah, treats it as data, exactly. So there's really no way around that at a hardware level that I know of.
Well, that's what this one guy kind of refutes, is that now you have to start learning, you know, better return-oriented programming, which is, you know, writing exploits to make code return wrong or to different places that can be executed.
Yeah, because if you return something, you're still in the program counter.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, this stuff's really, 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 really low level, but...
Yeah, I mean, most of you out there might think, just, you know, have in your head, oh, hackers, bad people. But really, the hackers out there who are doing this stuff are smarter than anybody you know. Like,
on a silver lining note, they're helping to help us find the vulnerabilities and make systems more secure.
Yeah, I mean, this pwn-to-own competition, the dude who, you know, hacked WebKit, now Apple has that code, they're going to fix WebKit, push it out to everybody else who uses WebKit, and now the browser's going to be that more secure.
Yeah. You know,
that much more secure. So yeah, there are people out there doing this for bad, but even the people who do it for bad, you know, people who write the software realize how they hacked it, and now they can fix the problem. So our last security-based article has to do with airplanes. So you know, anytime you fly, you have to shut off your phone because they say, you know, phones interfere. You know, they make you shut off your computer or any other electronics while the aircraft is taking off and landing, because, you know, they say the Wi-Fi will interfere if that's on while we're taking off and landing. And we're all like, yeah, whatever, really. I mean, we get it. We have to shut it off. But no, it doesn't. Well, turns out that Boeing and Honeywell did some tests. And yeah, Wi-Fi does actually interfere with aircraft. And they have these Phase 3 display units that are in next generation 737 airplanes. And it turns out that those display units will blank, just completely go blank, in the presence of Wi-Fi. So, next time you're on a plane, when they tell you to turn the stuff off, turn it off.
Well, I read through this, and I mean, they said that it only happens if it's in, if the Wi-Fi signal is at a much higher level than you would see in normal use. So,
still, I mean, stuff can malfunction. I'm gonna leave. You know, the reason they do all
I
this
mean,
stuff.
Any radio source, like anything that is emitting radio waves, is gonna emit interference as well.
Right.
But the interference is at a much lower level than the main signal. Okay. If that signal is turned up, any signal, if it's turned up enough, the sort of like sideband, you know, harmonics created by it could eventually overwhelm or saturate any receiver. I mean, it's orders of magnitudes greater power that it would take. But I don't totally like this article. I think it's misleading.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you. They are being very general and not explaining the details of it. But I also think that, you know, this kind of does prove why they tell you turn off your electronics, turn off your phones. Even though it's not normal, this stuff can happen, and you don't want it to happen when your life is at stake on an airplane.
Well, I agree that you should follow and listen to all of the instructions that a flight attendant gives on a domestic or international flight. But from what I've read, the reason that you're not allowed to use a cell phone has nothing to do with the interference on the plane. It's about how the signal now wreaks havoc on the ground because you're at such a higher vantage point in the air, and there's so many towers down below that you're now like sort of like
it can connect to like 30 towers.
Right. There's the towers work out which one gets like, you know, primary.
Right.
But from what I've read, that's the reason cell phones aren't allowed. Now, as for Wi-Fi devices, they don't have nearly the range. I mean, you know, cell phones like can do like 2 watts of power or something like that, where and also the towers have very high gain antennas, where Wi-Fi is like a couple milliwatts or something. It's much lower.
Yeah.
So you don't have nearly the problem that you do with cell phones. But that said, I'm not saying you should violate what they're telling you.
You just want to see more data.
I want to see more data. I want to see more realistic, you know, more realistic like interaction with modern technology.
Yeah,
like,
you want to see a laptop do this, cause this problem.
Yeah, well, that in terms of proving to me that it's really a problem. But B, like, I don't think it's a problem. I think they can engineer around the problem if there is one, and it shouldn't take over 10 years from the inception of a technology to see it on a plane.
That is true.
2001 is when we started to see the first really wide-scale 802.11b networks.
Why did it take until now to find this?
I mean, and it's not like we even really need, like, 802.11b is like, you know, throughput's like 11 megabits or raw, you know, and you can solid 1 to 2 megabits throughput. That's all you need for an internet connection. It's like, you know, for just to browse the website. Like, right. We don't need, like, the latest and greatest. We just need some kind of internet on there. It's like, these flights are forever long.
Yeah, you need something.
Ugh, anyway.
So, probably everybody heard, you know, we've been talking about it for the past couple weeks, that the iPad 2 was coming out. And I ordered one. I couldn't get to a store because Apple decided that the Apple stores would only start selling them at 5 p.m. last Friday. So I was on a plane back from Florida at that time, so I couldn't get to an Apple store. So as soon as I got back, I got on the internet and ordered one from Apple's website. And Apple's website immediately said the wait was 2 to 3 weeks. For it to even ship. Well, this article from devicemag.com kind of gives me some hope. Some people are already starting to see the shipping notices in their email boxes that their iPad 2 has been shipped to them.
Here's where I call advantage Windows. I have never had problems getting any Windows device when I wanted it.
Yeah, I was thinking about doing a joke sponsor. You know, this episode brought to you by Making Enough Devices. I mean, really, Apple?
Yeah.
This happens with every device they release. I don't know whether they do it on purpose or whether they really just can't judge the demand, but every device.
Yeah, I mean, even if they turn down like 1% of their customers, it's like good press in the sense like, oh my gosh, it's selling out.
Right. They can't keep it in stock. They're moving like hotcakes.
I'm sure they shoot for some goal. Like, they want to turn some people down, but like not more than X.
Right.
You know?
Right. Yeah, it seems like they severely, you know, undercalculated this one.
Yeah.
Because pretty much if you ordered it online, you're waiting. You know, you had to be one of the lucky ones who got it in the store that day. So I'm still waiting for my shipping request to come. I was pretty disappointed. But they say the beginning of April. So maybe the beginning of April, I'll be able to talk to you guys on how cool my new iPad 2 is.
Maybe.
Maybe. So, Ryan, I believe you have another article about a very cool Motorola device.
Oh, yeah. So the new Motorola Atrix 4G. I guess it's Ubuntu powered, and I don't really know a whole lot about this Atrix, but the thing that caught me is that it has like this laptop shell device that you can plug the Atrix 4G phone into, and then you get like access to like a bigger desktop and something, you know, more PC
like. Yeah, it's like a dumb terminal.
Well, yeah, it's like a dumb terminal, but you know, it has the brain from the, it's using the CPU and all the power that's inside the smartphone. I think this is compelling. Like, this is kind of a way, like, where the device really, you know, you don't have to worry about sync. This whole problem of sync goes away, at least with your PC. And
because your phone is your PC now.
Right. I'm surprised Apple doesn't have something like this because, like, you know, they have that iPad dock thing, but imagine just, like, buying, like, a all-in-one unit that you sit and you bring your iPhone home and dock it, and now you have this, like, you know, big screen, and it, you know, all the things that sort of suck about a small screen go away.
Right.
I mean, it would probably cannibalize sales of the iPad and their laptops and that sort of thing, but I think this sort of like whole PC tethered world kind of goes away if you have this sort of model where basically you take the storage and the brain power with you. And, you know, that way you have access to all your data on the fly.
Yeah, and when you come home, you have a full-featured laptop computer.
Yeah, no syncing required. Just plug right. the thing in and go.
Yeah, I see, you know, 2 points I wanted to bring up. You know, one, why you asked why doesn't Apple do this? I think one big reason is probably because it jeopardizes their overall design. You know, if you look at the Atrix, they have this big gaping hole on the side where the connector is that docks into this laptop shell. You know, Apple would never do that on their devices.
Well, they have a dock connector on the bottom that supports video and everything else.
Well, yeah, but they have one small connection on the bottom that is kind of hidden, but it looked like this was pretty big.
Yeah, but all you really need to do, like, if Apple were to do this...
So you're saying use the existing dock connector and just make it plug into a shell?
Yeah, basically they would just need to support two things. Like, if that output port on the phone actually supports like high def video basically or HDMI,
and it actually does,
yeah. So yeah. Bam, there you go. You can just support that, and then keyboard, mouse, USB, right? You just do like some kind of USB hub thing inside of the box, and then you just need one USB connection to the inside of the phone. It's like KVM type technology for the phone,
right?
I think it's cool. I mean, I don't know.
I do think it's cool. Here's what I want to know, though. So you're at home, you have the phone plugged into this device, you're using it as a laptop sitting on your couch, you get a phone call. What happens? You're not lifting the laptop up to your face. Like, well, how do you still get calls?
No, but like, I know when I have my BlackBerry, when I have the Bluetooth turned on my laptop, and it's connected to the BlackBerry, you can actually receive calls through like Windows telephony services or whatever. That'll, you know, you can like use the microphone and the speakers on the computer.
Oh,
so,
okay.
You know,
okay.
So I mean, it could just be like sort of like a speakerphone.
Right, right.
Or like maybe the phone app comes up and it looks slightly different. It's like a different phone app for the desktop.
Yeah, or maybe they force you to use like a Bluetooth headset or
something
like that. Yeah.
I mean, I think there's ways around it. And the cool thing is the other third thing they could support is a high speed data port, like, I don't know, Thunderbolt.
Thunderbolt.
Yeah, or maybe eSATA or something, where that shell you have, you could have like a gigantic hard disk plugged into it, or maybe just even like a gigabit Ethernet or something, so that you could have like at home offline storage for everything. And then,
or here's even better, if Apple does this, MobileMe, give that away for free to people, and now you have cloud storage of like lots of gigabytes.
No, nobody wants MobileMe.
I don't, but I'm just saying, you know, some sort of cloud storage where, because, you know, in your idea with the big hard drive in the dock device, you lose that when you go on the road. Whereas if you had some cloud storage, you always
have
it.
Well, maybe you just use the local storage for like high speed offline, like
backups,
and that stuff. And like maybe like while you're gone, it's able to sync up to the cloud. You know, maybe that thing has, it's not quite a computer, but maybe it's a SAN and it has a service that syncs it to the cloud.
Right, right.
You know, and that way you just leave it connected to your home network and it takes care of that while you're gone. I think there's some really cool, like, you know, possibilities with this. I'd never thought of that. You know, even though I have seen that HP Slate thing where the screen disconnected from the laptop part and you had like a tablet that ran some lower profile
when
OS.
It was connected, it ran
Windows
like
7,
a real OS, and when you took it off, it was Android something,
or like Ubuntu or something.
Yeah.
But it's cool. I thought it was cool.
Yeah, I want to see this in action. Like, this is one thing that I can definitely say. I want to see somebody using it.
Yeah.
So our next article, we are back to Facebook. And this is pretty cool because it seems like Facebook wants to bust what they call the SMS profit cartel. So this is from CNN's Fortune. I guess CNN owns everybody now. So Fortune magazine. You know, now owned by CNN Money. They basically say that with Facebook and all of their new messaging services, that this seems to be the way that people are communicating with each other. And they seem to be saying that text messaging, normal SMS, might go away if this Facebook messaging takes off because everybody you know is on Facebook. And if they implement a good enough messenger, then all of this, you know, as they say, 50,000-fold overcharging, which is basically what happens, you know, you pay $15 a month for a text message plan. That cost is about $1,000 per megabyte.
Yeah.
Because of how small text messages are and how much you pay for them.
Yeah, or worst case scenario, you pay per message.
Oh, wow. Yeah. 25 cents a message.
You think about it, messages, what do they limit to, 160 characters?
160.
So, I mean, characters, if they're ASCII, they're like 7 or 8 bits. If they're Unicode, they're 16 bits.
Yeah, I think some of those 160 is actually control, so you might not get all 160, but whatever.
Right, but I mean, like basically what it boils down to is for a text message, you're looking at maximum like a quarter of a kilobyte. A quarter of a kilobyte. So, and they charge you 25 cents for that thing.
Right, so do the math. If this was your landline connection, you know, $1,000 a megabyte.
Yeah.
So your bill would be $50,000 a month.
Yeah.
You know, really?
It's ridiculous.
Yeah, so there, I hope this happens. Maybe not with Facebook, but some way to get companies to either have a better messaging service than SMS.
Well, you know, BlackBerry's been pushing their messaging service.
They
as
really
like
have.
A side track to this. Like, hey, if you get a BlackBerry phone, you get a BlackBerry data plan, you're already paying for that. You can use BlackBerry Messenger for free over the BlackBerry data plan. And you don't need text messaging if your other people use BlackBerry Messenger.
Yeah, I think we brought this up a couple weeks ago that the new BlackBerry commercials were really pushing BlackBerry Messenger.
Yeah.
Yeah, I want some company to get rid of this overcharging for SMS because I hate paying $15 a month for 1,500 text messages. Like, really?
I'm surprised there hasn't been any apps to come out that have used the sort of like email loophole with text messages in terms of like,
I think there might be,
you know, like you can email anyone with a text message account. It's their phone number at whatever the phone carrier's like address,
vzwtxt.com or attText.net or something.
Yeah, they all have like an extension on it. So like if you made an app that just took your contacts in, and you'd have to tell them which service they're on, which would be kind of a pain,
right?
But you know, you could sort of skirt the whole text messaging feed.
Actually, you might not have to, because I remember that, you know, whenever I'm trying to look up somebody's phone number, if somebody calls me, I don't know, I put it into Google, it'll tell me whether it's registered with Verizon or AT&T. So maybe these apps can figure that out on their own.
Yeah, maybe it could. Although I don't know if that takes into account number portability or not.
That's true.
Like my number is originally an AT&T number, which I took to Nextel, then took back to Verizon. So actually, it was AT&T, took it to Verizon, took it to Nextel, then back to Verizon.
Yeah. Yeah, I know there are applications that do this because people with iPod Touches can text message me. You know, I've gotten texts from somebody who only has an iPod Touch.
Yeah.
And those don't have 3G chips, you know. They're not a cell phone.
Yeah.
So there's got to be stuff out there. So it's a sad day. It's a sad day for Microsoft lovers. Why is it a sad day? Well, Microsoft is not making the Zune anymore. You know, boo. I wanted to have like, da, 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 da. I wanted to have that sound, but I couldn't find it quickly enough.
Yeah, you know, I never got into the Zune. I mean, I had an iPod back when iPods were pretty much the only player you could get, or MP3 player. And the Zune looked cool. The reason I never bought a Zune is it never had enough storage for me. That was the reason. And that's the thing that's kept me away from the iPod Touch, is storage.
Do you know how the Zune works? Like, does it just appear as a hard drive?
Well, there's actually software, like sort of like iTunes, that Microsoft makes. It's called the Zune software.
I think that's what kept me from even considering it, is that I don't have a Windows machine.
Right.
So I wouldn't be able to use it.
Well, I think they actually make a Mac version for it now. They have for a while. But, like, from what I've heard, they say the Zune brand isn't going anywhere. Like, or at least they've said that in the past. And I think that what that means is that, like, the Zune software runs on Windows Mobile 7 or Windows Phone 7 devices.
That's what I was going to say. Windows Phone 7 is pretty much Zune.
Yeah, it has the Zune software on it for the media services. And then Zune also has, there's like the desktop like software. And I've never downloaded it, and I've never played with it, and I probably should. But I haven't ever owned a Zune, you know, so I haven't had a reason to. But I've read that it can completely replace like Windows Media Player, and it's much better than Windows Media Player.
Yeah, I don't like Windows Media Player.
Well, I like it for one thing, playing a video that you download. Like, that's it. Like, I don't use it to store music or libraries.
Right.
I don't do anything like that. And I found that some of the media sharing services that Windows Media Player provides seem to really mess with my router. Like, my router detects the device as like a media device instead of a computer, and then it like...
Oh, I've noticed that.
Yeah.
I just smacked my microphone, sorry. But I've noticed that whenever I have my Windows 7 VM booted up, if I also have my PlayStation turned on at the same time, a media server pops up on the PlayStation.
Yeah.
It's like, what?
See, now you can disable that. There's a thing called media sharing that's enabled inside Windows 7 Media Player, and you can also get to it through the network settings. It's sort of like a shared setting. But anyway, I don't like the way it works. It's not intuitive, and it mainly just has caused me problems, so I've just disabled it.
Right.
That also existed in Windows Vista, I think, as well.
Yes, yeah.
So, but anyway, back to Zune, I think, the Zune, it's got a lot of good reviews. I mean, it wasn't for lack of good reviews. People really like the device. I have some, you know, friends that really like it, but I never got into it, and I'm kind of maybe regretting it now that it's gone.
Yeah, here's what killed the Zune. They sold it in brown. that is what the downfall of Zune started, whenever they released a device in brown.
I don't know. I thought in terms of like looks, I think the Zune was a very like attractive looking device, especially the Zune HD.
Yeah, I think it was an attractive looking device. What I think really killed it was the... Now, I'm going to try to use the right word. It's not this word that I'm going to use, but the novelty of the interface. You know, every other MP3 player had a very similar interface, whereas when the Zune came along, it was kind of like a large step out of the ordinary from most other MP3 players. And I think unless you were, you know, a hardcore Windows person, you might have looked at that and said, whoa, I'm going to have to learn something new. I'll just buy this other thing. I don't know. That's my thought.
Yeah, I think it was different, but I don't think it was out of this, like, I don't know. It wasn't so different. I mean, you still scrolled down and got to your, you know, got to a certain artist and clicked it, and then...
Yeah. Yeah, I guess they all do have to kind of work the same. Just the look was a little different.
Anyways.
Yeah, either way.
R.I.P. Zune.
Yeah, so sad. But we do have one last Microsoft story, and this one is kind of like R.I.P. Nokia OS, because Microsoft is partnering with Nokia now. They are paying Nokia more than $1 billion to, quote, promote and develop Windows-based handsets as part of their smartphone software agreement. So basically what this means is that Nokia is dropping their own OS. You know, the quote in here was, this gives Microsoft scale and allows Nokia to rip out costs. Nokia, on their smartphones, they're not going to be making their own Nokia smartphone OS. They are going to be using Windows Phone, whatever version they decide to get, 7, 8, you know, probably all the new Microsoft versions when they come out. But what do you think about this? You know, Nokia seemed to be their own entity for a while, and now they're like, yeah, we'll just stick to hardware.
Well, the way I read this article is it's kind of a bi-directional thing. Like, basically, Microsoft is seemingly waiving the fee for the licensing for the operating system, and they have this basically $1 billion credit account, you know, that they're saying, like, all right, here's $1 billion, go advertise for us, and we'll knock off how many copies you sell. That's kind of the way I read it.
No, that's definitely right. Microsoft is using this partnership as a way to get more of their stuff out there.
Right. And in return, Nokia is getting free OS.
Yeah. They don't have to do software development on their own.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, so Microsoft definitely has a stake in this, but I just see it more from the Nokia side, as in they're not making software anymore. You know, like, a lot of people used to like Nokia phones because of that.
Because they made software as well?
Because of their OS. Like, it wasn't a smartphone OS. You know, it only did the things that they wanted it to do. They loved the way it worked. They loved the features. Now it's not going to be around ever.
Well, you know, I read an article. I don't think we have ever talked about this on this Songcast, but I read an article a couple weeks ago about after this deal happened, and somebody was like, sort of like, oh, poor Nokia developers, give it up. You know, MeeGo and Symbian is a lost cause. You waited too long to, like, refresh the thing, and now it's a lost cause. And I've never used it, but it seems to me that Symbian was, like, a first-generation smartphone OS that just didn't keep up with the times, and now it's showing.
Yeah, Symbian was around. I don't want to seem like an Apple fanboy too much, but it seems like Symbian was around alive and kicking until the first iPhone came out. And then Apple set the bars for what smartphones can do, and Symbian never caught up. Do you see it like that, around that time frame?
I don't know that their market share really fell off until really just the last couple of years. I think the more recent Apple push, I don't think the initial Apple iPhone is what killed it. I think it's the recent market acceptance of, like, maybe the last year, in addition to the explosion of, like, BlackBerry devices over that time.
Right.
You know, and Android. Don't discount Android. That was a huge hit to Symbian.
Yeah, so. isn't Symbian big in not North America?
Well, yeah, that's where it was. Basically, Europe is where it's huge.
Right, right.
And Europe and Asia, but
I wonder if it's still big there.
Well, I think it still has a commanding market share, but it was like over 50%. It's much less now.
Yeah. Yeah, so, I mean, despite me putting a negative spin on this, this does look like a good idea for both companies to do this. So, if you were holding out on a Nokia smartphone because you used to like what Nokia did with their software, go buy something else, because you're not going to get Nokia software anymore. Nokia phones are going to run Windows Phone 7 or 8. Man, two RIP articles. Man.
Yep.
All right. So have you seen anything cool and exciting over this past week?
No, not really.
Yeah, it seemed like a pretty dull week. There was nothing that new. So that is the end of the show then, with nothing else new happening this week. You can find me on Facebook and Twitter. My username is Slonkak. Ryan, if people want to look you up, where do they go?
You can find me on Twitter at @RyanLancey and now at www.lancipedia.com.
Ooh, you got your own domain.
Yes, I did finally register the domain name. So.
All right, lancipedia.com.
Yep.
And next week's show will be the Slongcast episode 28. So if you want us to talk about something, bookmark it on Delicious with the tag Slongcast028, and we will make sure to talk about it. So other than that, we hope you guys have a wonderful Tuesday evening.